and musicians. Thanks to our friends at the Wordstock Festival, we had the opportunity to speak with several superb authors. Essayist and journalist Andrew Lamb tells us why he co-founded New American Media, which is a coalition of thousands of ethnic media outlets. His fiction and non-fiction writings, including Birds of Paradise Lost, explore the interactions between the East and the West. But first, we speak with Jean Lerniang, who writes and illustrates award-winning graphic novels for adults and kids. He tells us about the controversy surrounding his most viewed The Last Airbender comic, and about the inspiration behind his latest novels, Boxers and Saints. Thanks for listening to APA Compass. My name is Andrew Ye, and today I have the pleasure to be talking with award-winning writer
Jean Lun Yang, and I'm a cartoonist. I draw comic books and graphic novels.
Jean Lun Yang is known for the graphic novels American Born Chinese and The Eternal Smile. His most recent work, Boxer and Saints, are companion graphic novels which tell the stories of the Boxer Rebellion from two perspectives. Jean, welcome to APA Compass.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So how did you choose to write about the Boxer Rebellion?
Well, I first got interested in the Boxer Rebellion in the year 2000. That year, Pope John Paul II canonized the 120 saints of China, 87 of whom were ethnically Chinese. I grew up in a Chinese Catholic church, and my home church was really excited about this. This was the very first time that the Roman Catholic Church had acknowledged Chinese citizens in this way. So there were all sorts of special masses and celebrations. Well, I looked into the lives of these canonized saints, and I discovered that many of them had been martyred during the Boxer Rebellion, during this war that happened on Chinese soil in the year 1900. The more I looked into this historical event, the more fascinated I became with it. I really feel like it embodies this struggle between Eastern and Western cultures that I've felt within my own life from time to time.
Tell us more about this struggle you felt.
Yeah, sure. I think my story isn't very unique. I think it's very true of many immigrants' kids. So I lived in two different cultures. I lived in a Chinese culture at home and an American culture at school. I had two different languages. I had two different names. And really, I had two different identities. I had to switch between one set of expectations to another as I went from home to school growing up.
What were your goals in writing Boxers and Saints?
Well, really, I wanted to explore this tension between Eastern and Western culture. You know, the Boxer Rebellion occurred at this time when the Chinese government was incredibly weak. It was at the end of the 1800s. China had just gone through a series of devastating wars. And people were actually predicting at that point that China was going to break up, that this one united country was going to break up into little pieces. All the Europeans and the Japanese had gone in and established what were called concessions. There were these small communities in all the major Chinese cities that basically functioned as colonies. They were there because they wanted a piece of China as it was breaking up. So a group of these boys, these young men who lived out in the farmlands of China, they were really angry about this foreign incursion into their homeland. So they came up with this mystical ritual that they believed would call the traditional Chinese gods down from the heavens, and these Chinese gods would give them superpowers. And then armed with these superpowers, they would run through the countryside fighting European soldiers, European missionaries, and Chinese Christians. And in this way, I felt like, you know, on one side, we have the Europeans with their own religious and mystical beliefs, and on the other side, we have these young men, these who eventually became known as the Boxers, with their beliefs in the traditional Chinese gods. So it was really this, it was almost like a metaphysical conflict.
You also want to tell the story from two sides, right?
That's right. That's right. You know, as in my research, I had a really hard time figuring out who I sympathized with more, whether it was these young men, these Boxers, or whether it was their Chinese Christian victims. And in the end, I just couldn't decide. So I came up with these two stories. The antagonists in one book are the protagonists in the other. Okay. What struck me in my research was this universality between the Europeans and the Chinese. You know, they had this really terrible relationship. They basically had the worst relationship that two cultures can have. It was they were locked in this classic oppressor-oppressed relationship. And despite that, I think that their cultures contain reflections of one another. So, for instance, back then, among the Chinese, there was this rumor that the Europeans would pluck out people's eyes and grind these eyeballs into medicines. And this was taken as evidence of how monstrous the Europeans were, how inhumane they were. Yet, if you look at Chinese religious stories, they have the story of Guanyin, who is the Chinese goddess of mercy. And in one of these stories about Guanyin, she actually plucks her own eyes out and grinds them into medicines for her father. So this rumor that they had generated about the other, about this other culture, was reflected in their own stories. Then on the other side, among the Europeans, there was this rumor that the Chinese would actually sacrifice their own children to their heathen gods. And this was taken as evidence of how monstrous and inhumane the Chinese were. But if you look at the European religious stories, the central story is about Jesus Christ, who is a son who was sacrificed by his own father. The dynamic was apparent on both sides.
So let's talk about American Born Chinese, which won the Michael Prince Award and the Eisner Award and many other accolades. So there's a Chinese American boy who just wants to fit in with the other white students in his school. And there's also a Caucasian American boy who's really embarrassed by his Chinese cousin and who exhibits all these characteristics of American stereotypes of Chinese people, you know, and exaggerated to the nth degree as well, right? So I'm American Born Chinese, and I can really actually relate to what both of those characters are feeling. And it feels really personal to me. So did you draw on your own experience as well to create those characters and feelings?
Yeah, absolutely. American Born Chinese is a work of fiction, but I definitely pulled from my own life for that. I think I experienced, you know, incidents of racism all the way through, but the most virulent racism that I experienced was in junior high. I think something about the insecurity of those years really brings out the jerk in people, you know, and a lot of the words that are said to my main characters in American Born Chinese, I heard in the halls of my junior high.
And addressed to you as well, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
How did you actually resolve understanding how you as a minority would fit into this majority culture?
Well, you know, part of it was by doing this book, by doing American Born Chinese. You know, American Born Chinese was much better received than I ever thought possible. And it allowed me to go to different places to do these speaking engagements where I talk about the issues that I bring up in the book. And at these speaking engagements, I've always been really struck by how common, how universal this experience of being a minority is. I have people who are immigrants' kids, and their parents may come from anywhere in the world. But it seems like we all have gone through these same feelings, these same emotional realities.
Do you have a particular favorite authors or artists?
Yeah, sure, of course. I think I find a lot of inspiration in Jeff Smith's work. He did a book called Bone that was really popular. And I think when I encountered Bone, it really proved to me that you didn't have to just do comics about superheroes to be successful. I also really admire an independent comics creator named Linda Barry. She did a book called 100 Demons, where she really combines stories from her childhood with fiction to create something that's very endearing and very personal. I think I'm also deeply influenced by my own friends. I came up in the industry with a group of cartoonists who are based in the Bay Area. There's Lark Pien, who did a book called Long Tail Kitty, which is amazing. It's an amazing kids comic. Derek Kirk Kim, who did a book called Same Difference in Other Stories, and he also has the series called Toon. That's sort of a cross between science fiction and romantic comedy. And the next volume will be out in November. It's a beautifully done book. And Jason Shiga, who's another Bay Area cartoonist, he did a book called Meanwhile that's a choose-your-own-adventure comic, and he's very clever. He works in all sorts of mathematical principles into his book. So I think my influence really come from both cartoonists who are a generation above me and my own peers.
So how did you get involved in the Avatar, The Last Airbender series?
Well, that's funny. I was a huge fan of the original series. You know, Derek, my friend who's also a cartoonist, was the one who first introduced me to it. He loaned me the DVDs of the first season, and by the third episode, I think I was just hooked. I just found that it was, in my opinion, it's probably the best written American cartoon series that's ever been produced. The writing and the characters and the depth of plot is astounding for a kids show on Nickelodeon. After the series ended, they made this announcement that they were going to create a live-action adaptation of this cartoon series. And at first, I was really excited about it. I really wanted to see you know, Appa in his full CGI glory. But then after they announced the casting, I was incredibly disappointed. I was more than disappointed. You know, I felt like the casting for The Last Airbender movie was just the latest example of yellowface, of this tradition within Hollywood of taking roles that would most logically go to Asian or Asian American actors and giving these roles to white actors. So even though within the cartoon series, it was pretty apparent that all the major characters were either Asian or Inuit, in the movie version, they were all played by white actors. I did a webcomic about how I was never going to see this movie over the casting issue. I put it on the web, and out of everything I've ever put on the web, that comic got the most reads, got the most hits. One of the people who saw that comic was an editor at Dark Horse, who was also familiar with my other work. She had read American Born Chinese and a few of my other graphic novels. So when Nickelodeon asked Dark Horse to create this graphic novel continuation of the original Airbender series, she called me up and asked me if I wanted the job. And I jumped at the chance, simply because I was such an admirer of that original show.
So I remember when the live-action movie for The Last Airbender came out, and some of the surrounding controversy about the casting. But the casting didn't change. I don't think any additional Asian Americans got on the cast because of the, you know, because of the outcry about it. Yeah. Did you see anything concrete come out of that effort?
Well, you know, the organization that that led the boycott of that movie is called racebending.com, and I think they do a lot of really important work. They are strong advocates for you know, minorities within American entertainment industries. And while I guess my view of the work of organizations like Racebending is they keep us from moving backwards. They keep us from falling back into these habits that have been ingrained within the way American entertainment industries do things. But in order to move forward, I think we have to rely on Asian American storytellers, you know, minority storytellers. As long as we're able to tell compelling stories that are rooted in our own lives, I think people will jump on board.
So I'm speaking today with award-winning graphic novelist Gene Lian Yang. His latest work is Boxers and Saints. Gene, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm Andrew Ye for APA Compass.
Talking with Gene Lian Yang, who is an award-winning graphic novelist, and we have copies of Gene Lian Yang's epic two-part book, Boxers and Saints. It's two volumes. Boxers and Saints telling parallel stories of Little Bao, a Chinese peasant boy whose village is abused and plundered by Westerners, claiming the roles of missionaries. And the second volume, a girl whose village has no place for her is taken in by Chinese missionaries and finds for the first time a home with them. This is available for a $90 pledge of support. That's $7.50 a month if you want to pay by monthly deduction from checking. But the way to find out is to call one of our volunteers back here and ask them all about it. The number is toll-free, 877-500-KBOO. That's 877-500-5266. I am hoisting this set of Boxers and Saints right now. It is very heavy, and it will be a very, very heavy read for yourself. A good long wintry read while you're snowbound this weekend, perhaps, or it could be a great gift for somebody, Valentine's Day gift for anybody on your list. But it's available now when you call KBOO at 877-500-KBOO, 877-500-5266. The folks here have made their way into the studio just to hear your call. We're hoping that you will take this moment to make them happy, give them a reason to be here, to have skied all the way to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. And if you're out and about and you'd like to stop in, you can certainly do so. Have a cup of coffee and a bagel here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. You can also contribute online at kboo.fm. But the best way to do things is by calling toll-free 877 500 KBOO. There's only three copies of this two-volume set, Boxers and Saints. You just heard Gene Luan Yang. He's a fantastic guy, very friendly. He came into the KBOO studios to talk to Andrew Yeh. And we have the books here, so call right now, 877-500-5266.
You know, we've got a $500 goal for this show this morning, and if we sold all three of those copies, we would be well on our way, because it's a $90 minimum pledge, and you would be helping your community radio station. Everybody's at home. A lot of folks are at home today, maybe listening to the radio in the morning. It's a great thing to do. Just give us a call. The amount that you give is up to you, but you need to do it to give to this community radio station, because that's how we stay on the air. 877-500-5266 is the way to do it. It's an easy thing to do while you're sipping your cocoa in your bunny slippers this morning, because so many folks have the day off. We would love it if you would come, if you would call us and contribute to this amazing institution. You know, 48% of the money that we get from y'all is spent for broadcasting issues, 27 on administrative, that's staff, professional services, insurance, you got to have that, you know, and 25% is for fundraising, that stuff called paper, pencils, postage, and thank you gifts. So this is how we spend our money. It is frugal. It is not there's no ivory tower offices or junket trips, though it might be fun. So give us a call, 877-500-5266. That's the most important thing to do. Do it, and do it now.
And we'd like to thank Christine in Portland, new member of KBOO. Thank you, Christine. And let's see. I'm having a little trouble reading this person's name. A new renewing member.
Shay,
in Portland.
It looks like.
Shay, looks like. Thank you, Shay. And
no, it's Judy. Judy, thanks so much.
And thank you both. And we know that you want to thank the members of the of Andrew Yeh and the members of the
APA
Compass Collective, who do incredible work here, put out an hour-long show that has all kinds of content. And you can get a copy of Boxers and Saints, the Gene Luan Yang graphic novel set, when you call in at 877-500-KBOO.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass. My name is Andrew Yeh, and it's my pleasure today to speak with award-winning author, essayist, and short story writer Andrew Lamb. He's also the co-founder of New American Media, an association of thousands of ethnic media outlets in America. His latest book is the short story collection, Birds of Paradise Lost. Andrew, welcome to APA Compass.
Thank you.
Andrew, could you tell our listeners about your personal and family history, both in Vietnam and in the United States?
Sure. I was born in the middle of the Vietnam War, and when I was 11, going on 12, the war ended. And my father was a high-ranking member of the South Vietnamese Army, and basically he got us passages out of Vietnam. So I flew out at the end of the war, just before they bombed the airport, and then lived for some period of time in Guam as a refugee, maybe a month, and then moved on to my American life in San Francisco, and went from 6th grade to 7th grade, switching from this Vietnamese kid who spoke French and Vietnamese into this American boy who basically ran away from his memory for a long time and became American. And it took me a long time to come back to it.
You ran away from your memory.
Yeah. I changed my name to Andrew. My French name was André from my French classes. And I pretended I was American born. I didn't want to have anything to do with Vietnam. I felt really sad about having lost the country. But because the shock of having lost the entire country and everyone else in it, I couldn't bear it. And so I just sort of pretended amnesia. And I think it's kind of ironic that in the end, as an American adult, I actually make a living addressing my losses and tragedy of my people. For as someone who fled from it, it's kind of funny that it became my preoccupation.
So how long did it take you to feel comfortable again with your identity
It took a long time. I mean, I remember even as a teenager, I invented narrative of my past. Like, I'm half French, or because I spoke French, you know. So I'm actually have French ancestry. Anything to sort of dilute my Vietnamese. I was ashamed, really, of having lost an entire country and be called a refugee boy and stuff like that. So I didn't want to do anything, to have anything to do with that. And I think in some way, what brought me back really was a heartbreak in college. I fell in love with someone who was Vietnamese. And when that relationship ended, I started writing about the lost love. And I came to a passage in which I say something along the line of, if you love someone and share a life with someone and you lose this person, it's sort of like losing an entire country. You have, in fact, became an exile. And then I read that passage again at some point and cried. But I wasn't crying about the heartbreak. I was crying for my lost homeland for the first time as a college student at Berkeley. Because the heartbreak really led to this whole process of mourning the lost homeland. And words poured out of me, and I started writing about what it's like to lose an entire country, what it's like to be a kid standing in a refugee camp, looking at the adults screaming and yelling at the news of the fall of Saigon. What is it like to sort of, you know, not knowing where you're going? And so it all became a kind of what the French call the cri de cœur, cry of the heart. It becomes like a survivor's guilt narrative, and which sort of led to the first book, Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora, that won a Pen Award. But that was really the process of returning for me.
So your initial writing was the audience for yourself mostly then, as an act of catharsis?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't aware of how people might or would react to the writing, so mm-hmm. much as it was a need to sort of give framework to my sadness, I guess. But the amazing thing is, I remember when I read some of my work out loud when I was at SF State, and even the professor cried. And it was the first time I read one of my work out loud in the autobiography class. And it stunned me that the language and that language and story has that kind of power, because I was always the recipient, and, you know, which is I read stuff that make me cry, but I never thought I could write stuff that make people weep. And it stunned me that was within my power.
So you made this transition of writing for yourself to writing for a larger audience.
Yeah.
And who is that larger audience that you're trying to reach?
I'm not quite sure. I used to think that it was to explain to people who didn't know my history. When I was at Berkeley, which is a completely lefty school, which is very anti-war, it had very stereotypical image or storyline about Vietnam. You know, people from the South were corrupted, or were prostitutes, and the North were ideologues and heroic, and, you know, Ho Chi Minh was great and everybody else sucked, you know. And I had to go and explain to them that, in fact, it was a civil war where both sides had people who were idealists. In fact, my mom's family split in half. It's not as simplistic as Berkeley would have had it or America would have imagined it. So I always thought I was explaining the complexity of Vietnam to people who only had stereotypes. But when Perfume Dreams came out, what's amazing to me was young people who were born here, Vietnamese American, second generation, who knew nothing about Vietnam, and whose parents, because of their own trauma and sadness and, you know, horror of the past, they wouldn't even tell the kids what really had happened to them. And because of it, the kids, for the first time, were reading about their own communities, their own diaspora history and emotional life of that community in English for the first time. And so they came up to me at various universities and said, thank you for writing this, because this is the first time I realized what my parents must have gone through.
So there are some people in the second generation that appreciated what you wrote,
yeah,
because it gave them knowledge that they didn't have otherwise. Now, the first generation, the immigrant generation, did they agree with your words, or were they
Or that's a good question. My parents are wary because, even though I thought Berkeley was lefty, I'm not at all on the right side of a lot of political debates. I was the first to recommend that the U.S. to lift the trade embargo with Vietnam. I always thought interaction would spur change in that country, whereas the older generation, my parents' generation, wouldn't have anything to do with Vietnam. Vietnam was under communist police state, and it needs to be embargoed until it falls apart, like the idea of embargoing Cuba or something. But of course, we know it doesn't work that way now. And in fact, now it's a normalized situation where people fly back all the time mm-hmm. and invest and all that. But until 15 years ago, recommending normalization with Vietnam was sort of being equalized to being a pro-communist, And so for a long time, there were a lot of disagreements between the older generation and me, who represent the one and a half generation, young enough to remake themselves in America, but old enough to remember what Vietnam was like, even though we have the same hope for the country, which is democracy and multi-party system and human rights. The process of how we interact with that country was seen very differently by the two generations.
And we are briefly interrupting this programming today because it is our winter membership drive, and we get the opportunity to invite you, dear listeners in Radio Land, to give a little back to your community radio station, the mighty 90.7. We're on the air because of your generosity. We're hoping you'll start or renew your membership right now. Toll free, 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. Or online securely at kboo.fm. My name is Justin, and I'm joined by Ani, and we are trying to entice you, dear listeners, on the second day of this winter membership drive. And we've got a captive audience here with people in from the snow. Why not really turn this into a great snow day and shower us with money? 877-500-KBOO.
And we'd like to thank Joe in Newburgh for renewing. Thank you so very much, Joe. It's important that you take this moment to do exactly that right now. Renew your membership to KBOO or make your membership brand new. It is your time. This is your moment. Come on in and join the family. 877-500-5266. We are on the air with APA Compass right now. It's a unique radio show that really highlights contributions and culture of Asian Pacific Islander Americans. It is so important that we actually build these bridges, that we understand each other's cultures, that we understand each other's histories, that we, in fact, enrich each other's lives in this interwoven tapestry that is community. And KBOO is the hub of that community here in this area. It is why, in fact, you are dialing 877-500-5266 with your support right now. Just $5 a month or $10 a month is an easy way to make a contribution and to participate in KBOO in a regular way.
It's about real people making real radio, and we're lending voice and making time on the air for the public airwaves to hear from Asians and Pacific Islanders, from all of our different cultural ambassadors from A to Z around the world every hour of every day. It's about lending voice and about enriching the entire community. Ani, you're exactly right. But that hub has to have the power on. The lights have to be on. The transmitter has to be working. We have to have the doors open in order to extend the training, to extend the signal further and further, and the intercats are really allowing us to spread that word far and wide at kboo.fm. But we're asking you to think about what a community would be like if it didn't have that rich tapestry, as Ani says, if there wasn't a place trying to lend voice to all the different communities. Well, it would look like Fox, MSNBC, Comcast, Drek. So this is really enriching, and we're not asking you to like every hour equally. I mean, perhaps the heavy metal vomit party at 3 a.m. is not exactly your cup of tea. But what we're asking you to do is to support the tapestry, to make sure that everyone who comes in and gets training has a shot at lending voice. 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO.
This is your moment to jump on in. We are here in the second day of our membership drive, and we have about $400 left to raise in this hour to make goal. And, you know, I am occasionally goal-oriented, especially when it comes to supporting community radio. It's important that we work together because, in fact, it is only through our efforts that we remain independent, that we remain in-your-face radio, that we can do things that are a little edgy, that are, in fact, not necessarily going to sell soap flakes and toothpaste. That's not what we're about here. We're about being cultural ambassadors, about building bridges. Call us right now, 877-500-5266. Yes, Justin?
I thought you were fixating some more on heavy metal vomit party, but I can see that you weren't. The point is that there are these different voices in the community, even in a town that is considered to be lacking diversity from compared to some other towns of equivalent population. We have lent voice to so many different folks, and the APA Compass is exactly the kind of mission that we exist to bring to you, dear listener. So please, when you're giving that money, you're giving money for all the different voices. You're starting your membership. You're making it possible for people. And we like to sweeten the pot here. That's the way we do it. We do have boxers and saints here. And we are looking at this beautiful box set. And we want to get that into your hands, dear listeners, for a $90 minimum gift at 877-500-KBOO.
And right now we are listening to that interview with Andrew Lamb. And we also have Andrew Lamb's book, Birds of Paradise, here for a $75 minimum pledge. So think about what you can afford to give and then give it. Go ahead and make that call. You can do it just on a monthly electronic funds transfer, we call it. Birds of Paradise could be yours for $6.25 a month. It is such a deal.
$8.50
$8.50 a month could get you boxers and saints. That's right. $90 minimum pledge. Call us right now. 877-500-5266. I love this box set of boxers and saints. It's graphic novels. It is, in fact, something you might want to show around. 877-500-5266. Give us a call.
Yeah, it sort of came out from Pacific News Service, which is, of all things, a wire service that was created as an alternative media during the Vietnam War, you know. It was back in the mid-90s when we started to see a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment rising in California. And so my boss, Sandy Close, basically asked me to do a story looking at how ethnic communities and ethnic communities media react to this growing anti-immigrant sentiment in California. And I asked her, well, where are they? How do we find these people? I mean, in my community, there were Vietnamese papers that I read sometimes, so I at least know where the Vietnamese papers were, but I didn't know where the Korean, the Chinese, the Hispanic, Black papers were and what they're even called. Mm-hmm. You know, and she said, I don't know either, so why don't you look in the yellow pages? And I thought, okay. So I look in the yellow pages and I found at least 12 and I interviewed them. And then what they had to say were really fascinating and a lot of times similar to each other point of view. And yet these people who lived sometimes two blocks from each other, this mom and pop shop with their own community papers, never talked to one another and didn't even know the other one existed. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was this whole sort of synchronicity thing happened where they just love talking about, you know, why they do what they do with so little money. And yet their service is so crucial in serving information to community that may not be able to digest American English language news. And yet, you know, sometimes they break a story that really big stories. And then those stories are basically pirated or stolen by mainstream media, you know, and they never get any mm-hmm. recognition. Mm-hmm. For instance, one woman who actually now works in our office worked for India West, and she broke the news that McDonald's actually used beef oil to fry fries in, well, here, but also in India. And that sort of really drove Indian, you know, into rage because they don't eat beef, you know, and that was a big story, you know, and yet, you know, it was like that kind of coverage get bigger when like Wall Street Journal picks it up and do that story. But they don't necessarily say, oh, India West broke this story first. You know what I mean? So what we did was a way we brought attention to this sort of under-radar journalism that have been doing great service to their own community and yet never really get any recognition.
You mentioned there's like a lot of differences in, between the different ethnicities and maybe not so much overlap in maybe the news stories that they cover, right? So what sort of synergies have you been able to
gain? Sure. I mean, for instance, when we just did, before I came up here, the story on how ethnic media view the shutdown in federal government. And a lot of them say, you know, this actually hit people of color a lot worse than you think. You know, almost half of the people on furlough in federal employment are people of color, you know. And, you know, Native American complained that, you know, all their parks, because they're on park, are shut down. And, you know, that affects them. You know, so there's a lot of interest because the shutdown affects people of color probably disproportionately more than even the mainstream population. So that kind of point of view wouldn't have been out there if we didn't do the kind of cross-posting and interviewing and bringing that kind of narrative into inclusive journalism. When we get fund from, say, a big foundation to do fellowship writing, which means we give local reporter a few thousand dollars to do a series of stories about, you know, immigration and how the new immigration reform issue is related to their own community, we get a lot of interesting stories that we wouldn't get otherwise, you know, that's reported from within those communities rather than to written about those communities. And so we actually, on New American Media website, we elevate those stories by syndicating them to other ethnic media. So we kind of cross-posting, cross-sharing across this horizontal line of ethnic media.
So in your second book, East Eats West, you write about how Asian immigration has changed the West as well. Could you say a little bit about that?
Sure. So it's still autobiographical in many ways, but it's a look at how in my lifetime in America, America itself falls into this spell of the East, or the Far East. And so I started talking about how, for instance, Vietnamese pho soup, you know, the beef noodle soup, sort of comes like this primo number one soup that everyone raves about, you know, or Vietnamese banh mi sandwich, you know, which is now, strangely enough, is now the thing that the Iron Chef competition makes, you know. And to Vietnamese, it's always a source of giggle because the banh mi is something that we eat every morning. You know, it's nothing so special to us. You know, it's sort of like you having eggs and sandwich and, you know, or bread. Rachel, you know,
Rachel Ray.
Ray is now like screwing up with the pho soup by telling people on the Food Network that it is a Thai-inspired dish. Oh. And then all the Vietnamese, I can imagine, like throw fish sauce on their TV set. But the fact that this woman who's not Vietnamese is teaching American how to make pho soup, you know, it's really amazing to me. But that's just one angle of East Eats West. The other would be how religion, I mean, Buddhism is now the third fastest growing religion in the United States. And you have people converting to it. And the most complex city of multiple sects of Buddhism is nowhere in Asia, but in fact in LA with over 300 Buddhist, you know, centers. Because you think about it, Tibetan Buddhism would be in Tibet, right? And Japanese Zen Buddhism would be in Japan. But they wouldn't mix. The only place that they would mix, it would be in LA. You know what I mean? So the most complex ideas of Buddhism can only be had in a city where they also have Disneyland. You know? So I find that really fascinating, you know? And so I think that all this expectation of where culture should be is completely displaced now by the forces of globalization.
So tell me a little about your third book. The latest book, Birds of Paradise Lost.
You know, if I say the first book is the cri de cœur, the cry of the heart, Birds of Paradise Lost is really the labor of love. It was what I went to creative writing school 2 decades ago for, you know, which is I wanted to learn how to write fiction. But you know, you never know when life sort of derail you a little bit. I became a writer of nonfiction mostly, and, you know, writing for magazines and so on. And in fiction, there is a freedom to go inside a character, to embody someone that I otherwise couldn't possibly access, you know, as a journalist. So all these years, you know, when I have a great inspiration for an idea, for a story, I jog down a little bit and come back to it. So after some years, you know, I compiled 13 that sort of come into a kind of a framework of a love story for the Bay Area. And then looking at Vietnamese living in the Bay Area and their adjustment, their immigrant experience, their trauma, but also their effort to integrate and remake themselves. And so it becomes this book called Birds of Paradise Lost.
We've been chatting with award-winning author Andrew Lam, whose latest book, Birds of Paradise Lost, was recently released. Andrew, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Andrew.
I'm Andrew Yeh for APA Compass.
And here we are briefly again interrupting programming, which is something we don't generally do throughout the calendar year, but once in a while we come in and we ask you to help keep the lights on, to help lend voice, to help make sure that the public has access to the public airwaves. Indeed, it is our winter membership drive. And dear listeners in Radio Land, with your, we're trying to take advantage of our captive audience here and not take advantage of you exactly, but take advantage of the opportunity that you're home from work and you're listening to the radio and you're reminded at how many different voices there can be rather than just the same old commercial talking heads that you might have gotten used to. So won't you get involved right now? Won't you join with so many others and make that call toll-free 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. Or you can do that online, always secure online at KBOO.FM.
And we want to thank some restaurants for contributing today to the membership drive. We would like to thank Delfina's Bakery at 4636 Northeast 42nd Avenue. We'd like to thank Eulaland at 118 Northeast 28th Avenue. And we'd like to thank Marrakesh at 1201 Northwest 21st Avenue.
And we would like to thank you, dear listener, when you call in at 877-500-5266. Then we'll know your name. We'll know a little bit about you. We'll know that you're one of the heroes for the community. And we'll know that you really believed in this fact of lending voice and making sure that everyone has a chance to play, as it were. And one of the things I've been thinking about is, you know, if you didn't have an institution like KABU in your life, you might think you were the only one who was nervous. You might think you were the only one who was aware of climate change, who was aware of political and social injustice, who was aware of rampant imperialism and environmental degradation. Because if you turn around to the other, avenues, the other media outlets, you really don't hear a lot about that. You hear about whitening teeth and freshening breath and melting away pounds. But you might think that you were the only one, but one of the things that KABU is doing is linking up a whole lot of people who are concerned with all the different issues facing our local town, our region, our country, indeed our world. You're not alone, because this is where you come to hear those voices, to hear voices active in social change, to hear voices who are smashing the patriarchy, to hear voices that are digging underneath the jibber-jabber in order to bring you real news, real culture, and real information. And that's what we're asking you to support when we ask you to start or renew your membership online at kboo.fm or from any phone in North America, toll-free 877-500-KBOO.
Do call right now and secure your copy of this box set of Boxers and Saints by Gene Luen Yang. You heard him earlier this morning. It is a brilliant box set looking at the Boxer Rebellion from a couple of different perspectives. It's a two-volume set, $90 contribution to your community radio station, and you can ask for that as your thank you gift. I know I would. It's really quite a good graphic novel with a good sense of history, and you learn a lot while you're, you know, reading it. 877-500-5266. Give us a ring right now and help us raise that last $400 of support that we will need, oh, in the next 13 minutes. We can do it with your help, but we can only do it with your help. 877-500-5266.
And you're listening to APA Compass. Today I speak with music producer Chops. He's a former member of hip-hop crew The Mountain Brothers and the creator of the successful Kickstarter project Strength in Numbers. In his career as a music producer, he has worked with a multitude of musicians and artists such as Lil Wayne, The Lonely Island, Nicki Minaj, and Kanye West, to name a few. The Kickstarter project Strength in Numbers brings together a collaboration of over 30 different Asian American artists. I catch up with him to talk about the Mountain Brothers, the Strength in Numbers album, and where he sees the project going in the near future. Can you tell us about how you started in music?
I started off in about third grade playing trombone. From there, I picked up a couple of other different horns and stuff. Around seventh or eighth grade, I started to hang around friends that were like into like drum machines and keyboards and pianos and stuff like that. And so I started to pick up a little bit of that too. And it just went from there.
Did you continue in music in high school or college?
I took some classes in high school and in college. I did not major in music, although I wanted to. My parents thought it wasn't smart. I majored first in engineering because that's what a good Asian kid does. After spending a couple years in engineering and realizing it wasn't for me and I couldn't hack it, I switched to psychology. I did pretty good in that for a while, but I couldn't say that my heart was in it. You know, I really wanted to do music.
Where did you come up with the name Mountain Brothers?
Mountain Brothers was from a Chinese legend called the Water Margin. The Mountain Brothers were some bandits that like lived in the mountains, and they were kind of like Robin Hood, kind of took from the rich, give to the poor, that kind of thing. So we kind of like the philosophy behind that.
But after the Mountain Brothers, you continued to make more music for other artists up until now, right?
Yeah, while we were working on Mountain Brothers, I would work with different groups around Philly and stuff like that. And we didn't really disband, like we kind of just, the guys were always focused on other things as well. Like the guys are like super smart. One of the guys is a doctor now and the other one does pharmaceutical research. They're both really heavy duty and they're smart enough and they were focused enough to do both. But I just kind of did the music. So I worked with other groups around Philly and then eventually I got opportunities to work with people who were connected to people outside the city and people in different areas and stuff like that. So that's how I started to be able to branch out.
What inspired you to create the Strength in Numbers project?
During the time of Mountain Brothers, I really wanted to do a label. Like I had a dream of having a label where all the artists would be Asian American, you know, but like my taste and my definition of what was dope, what I liked, people that I thought were really good. We weren't able to like find that many at the time. You know, there was a lot out that I know of now, but you know, back then, like the internet was not quite as strong as it is now. Like we had the internet, you know what I mean? But it's like, it wasn't as an everyday part of people's lives and people that were more ahead of the curve were into the internet. We had things like email lists and a website and stuff like that, but like there was not, you know, the Facebook, Twitter and all that to where it was really easy to just connect with somebody or like really easy to find like an Asian themed site that like, you know, here's a new group, here's the new song by this group. You really had to dig and find people. So there wasn't really a chance to do that kind of stuff back then. It was really getting into stuff like Facebook and Twitter that led me to finding the artists that are on the project. Like some of them I knew about before, obviously. Some of them I just only learned about like a couple of years ago. One of the sites that I found that I was really into was Channel APA. they would have like all kinds of like posts and updates about like, you know, here's the new song by like Decipher. That site got me into like a lot of different people that I didn't even know were out there and doing the things that they were doing. There were people like Dumbfounded that I knew about before. There was people like JK and Tasha that I knew about before, Bamboo and Geo Prometheus Brown. But people that are a little bit on the younger side, I might not have known about certain ones of them. And I found out about them through Twitter and through places like Channel APA. There was a couple main people that helped grow the idea, you know what I mean? One was Anne. She's on the Mountain Brothers song, and she's on like a ton of the songs on the album. We were in touch in like maybe 03, 04, something like that. We got back in touch through Twitter, I think it was, and we just connected over music and, you know, keeping an eye on the different people that were out there and just talking about who was dope and stuff. She's really good friends with Tasha and JK, so that's how they became involved. I would say Anne, and then also Rex Dizzy was a key person that was like, this group is dope, that kind of thing. Those were like early on some of the people that helped introduce me to artists and stuff like that. It really like branched though, because like artists would recommend each other, you know what I mean? Like Dumbfounded recommended Connie Lim. Joan Lee hooked up like a whole bunch of people, Little Crazed and Erica David. Bamboo hooked up like the entire Bay Area of artists. He's responsible for like a ton of the people on the album, so I definitely appreciate that.
What does the Asian American music scene look like now in comparison to when you first started with the Mountain Brothers?
It's interesting because there's so much more going on now, and there's so many more people that are dope that are out now. It's a combination of a couple things. Like, people have more access to things like video and like computers and stuff, and they let you make your tracks and record your music and shoot your videos and all that stuff, and you can edit it on your computer. We didn't have any of that stuff. I had like a room full of keyboards and like mixing board and all that stuff, and like, you don't need any of that stuff anymore. You just need a laptop pretty much, and you can do most of the same stuff, if not all of the same stuff. It's easier to get into now, and I think that that allows more people to be active. That combined with being able to network is really making a big difference now. And the talent is good too, because like nowadays you can learn stuff off of YouTube. If you want to learn how to DJ, or you want to learn how to like sing a certain run or something like that, or like rap battles are all on YouTube. So you can just learn that stuff without leaving your house. It's totally different now. And I think it's for the better. One thing that's been good about the Strength in Numbers project is I've gotten to meet people that are doing other things. Like, for instance, films. There's people that have expressed interest in maybe using some of the music from the project in movies. I've gotten the opportunity to hopefully do some scoring for a film. So I'm doing some of that. I'm getting back to making tracks for some of the people that I worked with before, previous to the project. And just working on some... I make a lot of music that's just me that doesn't necessarily get put out there, except for things like TV and movies and stuff like that. That's a big part of how I make my living, is through licensing of music. If you watch shows like Law and Order or like Grey's Anatomy or stuff, they have music, you know, in the background. So I've been, you know, doing more of that. Part of the way the project is set up is everybody that participates, I'm going to be participating on their project too. So we're getting some of that going too.
What was it like making the Strength in Numbers album?
It was the first chance that I've gotten ever to show different sounds within one project. Like, I've gotten the chance to work with different people, and like one sound for this person, a few months later, this comes out with this person and it sounds this way. I've never really had the chance to show different sides of myself production wise on one thing. With Mountain Brothers, we had some variety, but we kind of had like one style. Working with, say, for instance, people from the Bay that I've done stuff with, they have a style. Working with people from like Houston or Atlanta, they have a style. But I've never gotten the chance to do all that in one, and this has been a good opportunity to do that.
Where do you see the project going now?
I would like to see the Strength in Numbers project go further than it's gone. It's gotten a good amount of attention so far, and the Kickstarter was successful, and thanks to people like you and Peter and Keith and Phil, and I mean, there's a ton of people, but I'd like more, you know? Like, I don't necessarily see this as like for monetary reasons necessarily, but I would like it just to be bigger, or like, you know, we have 4 videos. I'd like there to be like 10. I'm proud of the project. I'm proud of everybody that was part of it and the way that it turned out. And I would like for people to know about it more.
Thanks for speaking with us today, Chops. Did you have anything else you wanted your fans to know about?
Thanks. Yeah, keep the eyes peeled and the ears open, because we're going to be doing a lot more stuff.
That's right, ears open. Ears open, lentils and geraniums. We are briefly interrupting programming again because it is the second day of our winter membership drive, and I've got just a minute to entice you over to your phones to call toll-free 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. We have a goal of $94,000 is the total goal for this membership drive, but right now $320 is what we'd like to have in about 2.5 minutes to do it. That might be three of you starting that sustaining membership of $120. We will get you set up on an electronic funds transfer. We shall put the fun back in funds transfer, and that will amount to $10 a month. $10 a month, it works out to be just 33 cents a day, but it costs $2,000 a day. Won't you do your 33 cents? 877-500-KBOO. You can do that online securely at KBOO.FM. It is your opportunity right now. Please don't wait for someone else to do it. There are thousands and thousands of you listening, but about 10% have made the call. It's a beautiful snowy day out there. Perhaps this is the destiny of our listeners today, to be kept at home, to enjoy our membership drive. You have resisted our entreaties for quite some time. Now, please, unclench. You're warming up. You're dry. You've got tea or cocoa or coffee, and just pennies, nickels, and dimes will get this baby done. 877-500-5266. Say thank you to our cultural ambassadors on the APA Compass and to all of the programmers every hour of every day. Maybe you want to pay for 1 hour. Maybe APA Compass is the hour you'd like to pay for. $84. That's what it costs. 877-500-KBOO. They're going to steal the mic from me in a minute. Let's have one more call. That sustaining membership, 33 cents towards the $2,000. 877-500-5266. 83% of KBOO's money comes directly from you and you and you and you. And let's add a few more. Let's widen the pie. Let's make the pie higher, folks, right now online at KBOO.FM. Help us make the pie higher and wider and rounder and flatter. 877-500-KBOO.
Hi, Love Jones here, DJ and producer for La Contessa de la Luna, late night host of The Confessional. I want to invite you to join her and a cast of tens to the Clinton Street Theater pre-Valentine's Day live show and extravaganza plus movie. Get ready for Thursday, February 13th, when she takes over the Clinton Street Theater for a live show featuring sing-alongs, talk like Christopher Walken contest, prizes, raffles, audience confessions, and a live performance by La Contessa de la Luna, featuring the KBOO dancers. The live show is followed by the film Dogma, featuring George Carlin and Matt Damon. That's triple the entertainment for one ticket, and all proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. That's La Contessa and Friends live on stage Thursday, February 13th, starting at 7 p.m. Tickets on sale now at brownpapertickets.com. Just search for KBOO. See you there.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the 24th annual Cascades Festival of African Films. Over 20 African films will be screened between January 31st and March 1st, 2014. Thursdays through Saturdays at Portland Community College, Cascade Campus, and Hollywood Theater. The films celebrate African achievements, expose Africa's failures, and reveal the possibilities for change and a more hopeful future. The majority of films were made by African directors. They show us pictures of Africa through the eyes of Africans rather than a vision of Africa that is packaged primarily for Western viewers. That's the 24th annual Cascade Festival of African Films at the Portland Community College Cascade Campus and Hollywood Theater from January 31st through March 1st, 2014. More information can be found at the right-hand side of KBOO.FM under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10:01 a.m. Coming up on Flashpoints, we have another in-depth interview about Lyme disease.
Coming up at 11, Shahid Hamid hosts a special one-hour It Takes a Village with guest Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. Yes, local homegrown blues legend. He will receive the who did receive the 2013 Paul DeLay Lifetime Achievement Award from the Cascade Blues Association. That's all coming up. In the meantime, here is Flashpoints. Oh, direct from our friends down south in the Bay Area.
On Flashpoints, we continue our ongoing series on the growing epidemic of Lyme disease. We'll be in deep conversation with Dr. Richard Horowitz, one of the leading doctors in the fight to call attention to the growing Lyme disease epidemic. Dr. Horowitz has treated over 12,000 Lyme-related patients and is the author of Why Can't I Get Better? Solving the Mystery of Lyme and Chronic Disease, and will feature more excerpts from the hard-hitting documentary Under Our Skin about the battle for Lyme patients to get proper care and treatment. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, California, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, we continue our multi-part investigative series on Lyme disease, and we're joined by Dr. Richard Horowitz now. He is a renowned doctor in Hyde Park, New York, who has treated over 12,000 patients with Lyme disease. Dr. Horowitz has just come out with a groundbreaking book called Why I Can't Get Better, Solving the Mystery of Lyme and Chronic Disease. And, well, we're delighted to have you with us, Dr. Horowitz. Important problem, and we're discovering a great deal as we unfold this series. Let's start at the beginning. How did you get involved with Lyme?
Well, I'm initially from Bayside, Queens, which is about 2 hours south of where I am now, and I just moved to the Hudson Valley, New York, after finishing my residency in internal medicine. And what happened is I moved into one of the largest Lyme endemic areas in the United States, and I had absolutely no idea. So I thought I was going to be a country doc just treating hypertension and diabetes, and then walked into this area where so many people were getting sick with Lyme. And, 75% of the people would get better with a one-month course of antibiotics, but 25% would keep coming back telling me they felt ill. And I learned in medical school a long time ago, you get to the source of the problem. You know, you treat people the way you would want to be treated. So I started looking at answers, and, 26, 27 years later, I now have found a lot of answers for the people who are sick with Lyme.
Well, and we're going to want to talk to you about some of those answers, but we've been hearing in the series that Lyme has reached epidemic proportions. As someone who is in the trenches and treated 12,000 patients, that's a lot of people, what is your feeling about the problem now? Is it a major problem? Is the medical system's denial creating a second problem?
Well, I think it's a very, very big problem, and I'm not sure people realize how bad it is. Part of the problem is that Lyme is the great imitator. So a lot of times people are diagnosed with diseases like chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, autoimmune diseases like MS. So part of the problem is the testing is not reliable. So you go to your doctor, they might think, oh, gee, that person could have Lyme, but they do a blood test, which is